Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Jury duty intrigues me, really. When you show up first thing in the morning at the courthouse, you find a remarkable cross-section of the local population. And even if you are not on the panel selected to hear testimony in a particular case, watching attorneys and other people questioning prospective jurors is fascinating. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The process is called voir dire, although lots of folks in Texas call it voir dire. It means to see and speak in French, and in a courtroom setting, it is the time when attorneys and judges try to determine whether anybody in the pool of potential jurors might be biased in the case or otherwise unqualified to serve. Watching the attorneys at the Frank Crowley Building do their thing a few weeks ago when I had jury duty, it occurred to me that voir dire is about a lot more than just the weed-out process. Joining us to talk about this are two guests well known as experts in the jury selection process. Jennifer Lipinski is a jury consultant with Kathy E. Bennett and Associates. Lisa Blue is a forensic psychologist and attorney with Barron and Blue. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're each known as experts in jury selection, and I'm curious from each of you how you cultivated those skills. And Lisa Blue, we'll start with you.
Well, I was a psychologist and decided to go to law school and really fell in love with trial lawyers and what they do. And it was because of my psychology background. I had been a therapist to a lot of lawyers. And one day a lawyer asked me to go to court with them and watch him pick a jury, and I just fell in love with what they did.
How about you, Jennifer Lipinski?
Well, my story's a little less educational, I guess. I was fresh out of college, and I got a job with Robert Hirshhorn, who's the owner of Kathy Bennett and Associates. And about 3 months in, he said, "You're too smart to be support staff. Do you want to do what I do?" And from that point on, I followed him around, basically. He's also an attorney, and I've been learning ever since. I feel like I'm still learning every time that he and I have a conversation. And along the way, I actually have met Lisa years ago, and I think she's brilliant. And I've learned from both of them all of the time. And then, you know, blink and you miss it, 16 years have gone by, and I've worked on several cases, and I genuinely love what I do.
Is there such a thing as an ideal juror?
I think it completely depends on your case, unfortunately, and I'm not trying to hedge. It really depends on its face, the simple answer is no. There is no such thing as an ideal juror because it really depends on too many factors that are so unique to each and every different case that we work on that I don't know that there's such a thing as an ideal juror.
So you have to start over with every case deciding who would be right for
you. Absolutely. Absolutely, in my opinion.
It's funny because lawyers ask me all the time, what's my ideal juror? And Jennifer knows this, and Robert and I know that this is a system where it's not a system where you get to pick who you want.
Right.
It's who you strike. So rather than think in terms of what is my ideal juror, you think, what is
who
my
do I not
worst
want?
Nightmare?
Exactly. Jury selection is actually a bit of a misnomer, and
yeah.
I tell people this all the time, because the two sides are not picking who they want on their jury. What they're doing is really a process of elimination. It's identifying people who you do not want for one reason or another based on your case and what you know about your case and then people's life experiences and biases. That's really the focus of it. So it's really jury deselection in a way. Because once everybody's exercised their peremptory strikes and cause issues and hardship issues have been dealt with by the judge, then it's the remaining jurors that are there. Those are the ones who are eventually in the jury box.
Peremptory strikes are the jurors in the pool, the larger pool, that you can strike without necessarily offering a reason to the judge. Is that right?
That's correct.
Is there any reason that you are not permitted? Is there any attribute that you're not permitted to consider when choosing to strike a juror?
Yes, you're not allowed to strike somebody based on race, perhaps gender, but definitely race. And if one side can prove the other side struck the jurors, for example, just because they're black, then they're entitled to make what's called a Batson challenge, and the judge will handle it. And a lot of times he or she, the judge, can put back jurors that party struck for race reasons.
a lot of people are aware that the Constitution guarantees us a right to, if we are a criminal defendant, to a trial with a jury of our peers. What does peers mean for purposes of the law? Because the people I might think of as my peers may not be the people that show up in the courthouse to judge my case.
Well, I think we have to remember that when a jury of our peers, when all of that language was written, it was a very different time. Now it just means people in the community. It doesn't necessarily mean who you think of as your peers. It means people in the community who are qualified to be jurors and that meet the federal guidelines. And then in addition, can fairly consider all of the aspects of the case that they're going to be asked to consider.
So we all fill out sort of questionnaires that are standardized before we go to serve jury duty. At what point do you get access to those, and are you able to sort of start looking through those?
Depends on the judge.
And the case.
And the case. If it's a very simple case, it's going to last a day or two. The judge may give you only 15 minutes to look at the questionnaires. If it is a month-long trial, it's a serious case where people died, sometimes the judge will give you a whole day to look at the questionnaires.
And in high-profile cases, sometimes because the summons go out so far in advance, you hear about – the ones I'm talking about are the ones you hear on the news where, you know, a panel of 300 people were summoned for jury duty, that kind of thing. A lot of times we'll get several weeks with those questionnaires. And it's just the judge – and Lisa said it best. I mean, it really depends on your judge. But a lot of judges are sensitive, especially in those high-profile cases, to give each side adequate time to look at everybody in the panel when it's that large.
What kind of information are you looking for when you have advanced access?
Well, if it's a high-profile case like I just mentioned, the number one is probably publicity and what opinions, if any, people have formed based on that publicity alone. I think a lot of – I didn't work on these cases, and some of them I did, but some of them I have not. But some of these recent high-profile matters where they said, no, I've never heard of this case, sometimes that's also sort of a – it makes you take pause because – and if it's been dominating –
How could you not have heard of this
right,
case?
If it's been dominating the news, how can you not have heard it? So you might consider that person more carefully as well. That's probably the number one thing for high-profile cases. In just your – and I hate to say run-of-the-mill because I don't mean it in the way that most people do. But in, like Lisa said, the 1 or 2 day trials, you're really looking for anybody who might have a bias or a prejudice against your client, especially for me as a consultant. I'm working for one side or the other. So I'm trying to help the person who hired me consider who's going to be able to consider their side of the case.
People enter courtrooms with a lot of biases. Mm-hmm. And a great trial lawyer can figure out by their communication skills, by getting people to open up, by treating it more like therapy than interrogation, how they feel about certain issues. People, a lot of people don't like lawyers. A lot of people feel like a lawsuit is a lottery. A lot of people feel like if you have been indicted, you are guilty. And so it's uncovering those biases, just as Jennifer said, to determine that juror is probably not going to be open to you presenting your case and be fair.
And that's the wonderful thing about our country is that we are perfectly allowed to disagree with the laws. We have to follow the laws, certainly, but we're allowed to disagree with them. And this forum, this voir dire, as you said, in Texas, you are correct. That's exactly how we pronounce it. We actually give people the opportunity to say, you know what? I know that's the law. I understand that's the law. I don't agree with that law. And it's absolutely fine to be able to do that. It just means you're not the right person for that case. And I also want to make one quick comment. I think when people hear the words bias and prejudice, they sort of tense up a little bit. Bias and prejudice mean different things in the legal arena than they do in just everyday life. A bias or a prejudice isn't necessarily a bad thing when we're in a courtroom, when we're picking a jury. In that, what I mean is if you have a bias or a prejudice against a certain topic, like Lisa mentioned, if you just think lawsuits are lotteries, that's a bias. That's a prejudice against people who bring lawsuits. And it's not the same thing as having a prejudice in a social arena.
How do you get people to admit to biases? The case that I was in, I was one of 77 people that were in this larger jury pool. And one of the attorneys said, does anyone in this room have a problem with homosexuality, and not a single hand went up. And part of me thought, well, this is fantastic. We've gotten to a place where Americans accept it. But then I thought, it's probably not true in a group of 77 people in North Texas. And then one gentleman, after some more questioning, finally said, well, I don't have a problem with individuals. It's against my faith. How do you get people to admit things that they know are socially unacceptable but could be germane in a particular case?
Well, the way I would suggest is I would make myself an example. And I would say to the jury panel, I used to be a prosecutor, assistant DA, and I was head of a child abuse section, did a lot of child abuse. And if I were on a jury panel, I would raise my hand and say, I'm biased. I am prejudiced against this kind of case, not because I'm not a good citizen. It's because I know too much about the topic. So number one, using yourself as an example. Number two, and I think most important, is to make the jurors feel comfortable enough to know that admitting a bias or prejudice, which just means a leaning, is a good thing. That's what the judge wants. That's what both sides want. And then this is important to tell the jurors, if you have a bias and you don't speak up, you could end up on this case and it could be the wrong case for you. And that could be detrimental for everybody.
There are also certain things that, may matter in a case that are embarrassing to admit. You know, if people have been affected by sexual assault or something, it's not easy necessarily to raise your hand in a group of dozens of strangers and admit to something. What do you do about that?
Absolutely. Number one, going back to the questionnaire topic that we were discussing a minute ago, if you are able to get a questionnaire in your case that is beyond just the simple form that you fill out when your summons gets mailed to you, that's a great place to be able to put those questions. And a lot of judges do permit this because people don't want to raise their hand in front of 60, 70, 100 people and tell their very personal stories. Let's assume, though, that you don't have that option and there is no questionnaire. And your scenario happens that they're asking, has there anybody been a victim of sexual assault? The best thing to do is at the front end of your voir dire is, for the attorney's part, is to tell them, if at any point I ask a question where you would rather speak to the court in private, just let us know. Because we need to ask these questions. We're not trying to pry. We're not trying to embarrass you. But we need to ask it so we can do the best job we can for my client. And giving them that permission to let them know that it's okay to say, I have an answer, but I don't want to say it in front of all these people, goes a long way. And it really helps a lot of people saying, look, and even then, though, I've worked cases where that exact scenario has come up. And usually a female has raised her hand and said, I need to speak to you privately, and then just flat refuses. I'm not going to tell you about this. I'm just telling you it's happened. And in that case, oftentimes the judge will excuse that juror.
How important is intuition?
I think it's tremendous.
People absolutely
that understand communication skills, social intelligence, being able to read body language. You just know in your gut that somebody is not going to like you. It's the same thing if you and I were at a cocktail party. Mm-hmm. You know within 45 seconds, do I want to stay here and talk to Lisa Blue or do I want to get my drink and move on?
All right, we'll talk more with Lisa Blue and Jennifer Lipinski, both experts in jury selection. We're talking about what happens during the process. If you would like to join our conversation, ask a question, make a comment, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today we are trying to demystify what happens during jury selection. We have Lisa Blue with us, who is a forensic psychologist and attorney at Barron & Blue, and Jennifer Lipinski, who's a jury consultant with Kathy E. Bennett & Associates. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think at kera.org. Can you plan strategy for the voir dire process based on what you know ahead of time with about the jury, what you might assume from that basic information that you have?
I think it's a little dangerous to assume what information. It also sort of depends. I mean, if you have information on your panel prior to the voir dire, then yes, you can do a little planning. If you, as far as follow up on certain issues that maybe that they disclosed on their juror questionnaire, for example, but I think without that information, I think it's a little dangerous to assume that certain people are going to think a certain way. I think you just kind of Kathy Bennett had a saying when in hers was ask the question you want the answer to. So mm-hmm. instead of trying to jump around and kind of dance around the issue, is ask the question you want the answer to, and then see what you get. Now, sometimes you get responses that you don't necessarily want, but that's okay too, because you have to have the knowledge. The scariest thing, I think, on a attorney's or consultant side in jury selection is putting somebody in the box who you have not talked to at all and you know nothing about. You know nothing about their background. You know nothing about what they feel or think about the issues of your case. And that's probably the most dangerous thing ever. And so you know, we always advise the attorneys, get everybody to say something. And we have tools and ways of having them do that. But you've got to talk to every single person, if at all possible, just because having no information is worse than whatever information that the prospective juror can give you.
You only have so much time to do your portion of this process. Lisa, I'm curious as to whether there is part of you that is beginning to build your case or at least frame your case for the people who will be seated on the jury before the 12 and whatever alternates have been selected.
Well, I don't think you ever want to spend more than 3 or 4 minutes framing your case or talking about your case, because the purpose of jury selection or voir dire is to get off the people that are biased against your case. And I think the biggest mistake lawyers make is when they get up for jury selection and they spend their whole time just talking about making it like an opening statement, not really wanting to get information, just telling them why it's a good case.
Agreed. I've been helping attorneys for a while now, and I can't tell you, it doesn't happen often, because we usually do some planning before the voir dire. But there have been instances where I'm using sticky notes going, ask a question, and putting it right in front of them, because sometimes they do that. I mean, attorneys are very good. The ones who are trial lawyers are litigators. They're the ones that want to get up. They want to be able to fight for their case or defend their client, whatever their position is. And so they get up there and they're trying to convince the jury instead of asking the prospective jurors before the actual jury is seated.
How often does somebody really surprise you? I'm thinking about recently I was driving down the road and there was a big old pickup truck and it had an NRA sticker and a gun rack and it had 2 Obama Biden stickers, which tells me that this is a person who doesn't necessarily fall in the categories we might assume about them. Does it happen every time that somebody takes you by surprise?
There's a lot of people that surprise me, and here's what I've learned. You can't stereotype people. Mm-hmm. You can't say a truck, guns, okay, and 2, a Biden, Obama sticker, that means certain things. What I would do with that particular prospective juror, I'd want to know what their belief systems were. There's got to be a reason why those 2 things exist within that person's world, the big trucks, the guns, the liberal stickers.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's you can no longer judge a book by their cover. I mean, there's all these, and I think unless you're in the legal field or know somebody who is, I think a lot of people depend on TV and movies to kind of inform themselves, or they think it's informing them on how the process works. And you see a lot of times in movies in particular where they're going, well, I don't want that juror. He obviously – I can't think of what this movie was, but there was somebody who was picking a jury and they're going, well, don't pick that guy. He makes his own clothes. And I don't remember why that was a bad thing necessarily. But the point is that doesn't necessarily mean anything. Maybe it's just a hobby. Maybe he just likes doing it. It has absolutely nothing to do with his core values. Mm-hmm. So that's – it. You really just cannot judge people just based on, you know, when they sit down and just look at you. It doesn't mean anything. But the flip side is also true. I was working with a lawyer who was saying that this one woman who had wonderful things to say, I liked her, and she was sitting there with her arms crossed the whole time. Now, while body language is absolutely important, I'm not going to say that it's not, this particular woman was just cold.
Right.
And this attorney was convinced that she hated him, and it just was not the truth at all. So you do have to take body language into account. Now, that being said, if she was scowling at him the whole time while her arms were crossed, sure, I probably would agree with him.
All right. What about this person? There's inevitably someone who, you know, the first time they are tapped to say something, they say, well, I'm going to assume that the defendant is guilty. She just looks guilty. Or they're going to say, I'm going to assume that this lawsuit is nonsense because all lawsuits are nonsense. That may be true, or it may be someone who just really, you know, doesn't want to miss work or doesn't want to participate. Do you still want to eliminate that person because they wouldn't make a very good juror regardless?
I would want to eliminate that person. My theory about jury selection, if somebody really doesn't want to be there, then I don't want them to be there because they're going to have resentment. They're going to have other things on their mind. They can't be mindful. They can't really focus on the evidence. They're just thinking about, how do I get out of here?
Mm-hmm. That, and they might inevitably sabotage the case for one side or the other, and they're a complete wild card. I agree with Lisa. I'd probably, and a lot of times, if they're somebody like that who's, you know, just a troublemaker, for lack of a better term, a lot of times judges will just say, can we agree to let this person go? And it doesn't require each side to use up a peremptory strike on that person because they clearly don't want to be there. They're very vocal about it. There's just no point in keeping somebody there who is that angry about being there and part of the process.
I'm kind of a rule follower myself, but I was stunned to learn that about 1 in 4 people who receives a jury summons actually shows up as requested, required by law. Why do you think people are so reluctant to serve on a jury?
I think their perception is that it's going to be this giant time suck, basically, in their life. Most trials are only 1 to 3 days, and I don't think most people understand that. A lot of trials are one day, and you're done in one day. A lot of people have this perception because of what is in the media and what is on what they make movies out of and things
right.
of that nature, of these trials that last months and months and months, and the jury's sitting there listening to evidence. Those cases are rare. That is not the status quo. And I think people's perception is, oh, no, how long am I going to be here? And I understand it, considering the information sources they're basing that opinion off of. I get it. I do. And I think that's why it's so important for judges to say at the forefront, I anticipate this trial will be X number of days, for instance. Because I've seen whole entire groups of people exhale when the judges said this trial will be done by Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And they go, oh, well, okay, that changes
things. I can
make
that happen.
Right,
yeah.
That changes things for me.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Joe on the line in Plano. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Chris. I have a few years ago, I was in the jury pool for a murder trial and went through the voir dire process. And what I saw something, I would like to know whether it was, whether it's common or legal. During voir dire, the prosecution team had a member who was from East Texas who had the strongest Texas accent I've ever heard. I'm a native English speaker, and I was having trouble understanding what she was saying, and she spoke very, very quickly, so quickly that when I got asked questions, I had to answer in full sentences because I didn't know if she was asking questions in the affirmative or negative. She was very, very difficult to understand. A ways into the voir dire process, I believe it was the judge who asked, is there anybody in the jury pool who would like to be excused because of language, their English ability. And basically, every ethnic member of the jury pool got cleared out.
Is that a typical thing that's happened? I don't know. What can you tell, Joe?
Well, the law is you have to be able to understand English and read and write on some level. And the judge will make that determination whether you're capable of sitting, whether you're qualified to sit, because if they can't read and write and their documents put into evidence, then that juror would be at a disadvantage.
Are you watching to see that people are paying attention in the jury pool? It seems that there are some people who, will be asked a question and then it'll be like seventh grade. The individual will say, "Oh, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?" And this happens multiple times. Is that a red flag?
Yeah, it's definitely a red flag. A lot of times, I think, other than the misconception of lengths of trial, the most common misconception by people who are serving, people on jury duty is that if I don't talk, they won't pick me. It's one of those back in school, if you sit in the back and you make yourself small and you don't, then the teacher won't call on you. And the opposite is true of jury selections. We even tell juries now, jurors who don't talk, walk. I'm sorry, jurors who talk, walk. I apologize.
So if you speak up, you're more likely to be eliminated.
Exactly. For one reason or another. Is if you're just honest and forthright and you tell the court what you think about the questions that are being posed to you, it's more likely that one side or the other might use a peremptory strike on you, or maybe there's something in your life or your background which causes you to not be able to be a juror in this case for, any of those reasons we've talked about previously. And I think people sit there and go, "Well, I'm just going to be quiet and I won't get picked," and that's just not the truth. So I think what Joe said was a little unusual for the judge to say, who's having trouble, because that sounds to me, and maybe I'm misunderstanding him, but it sounds to me that it was who's having a hard time understanding this one particular attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Like Lisa said, the statute says you have to be able to read and write English and understand English to be a juror. But if you're having trouble understanding one attorney, that sounds like something the trial team needs to decide upon what that person's role is if the entire veneer is having a hard time listening to him or her.
So you can't eliminate people based on race alone.
No.
Many people are concerned when a jury for a defendant of color, for example, is all white or almost all white. How much do you have to think in exercising the strikes that you have about what the demographic makeup will be of the jury that is seated?
Well, what you can't do is say, "I'm going to strike that person just because they're black," because the other side has the right to challenge it and say, "Judge, I want to know the gender, the race neutral reasons why they struck that person." So you have to be thoughtful in that way.
Does it happen that unscrupulous attorneys on either side can come up with some other reason that otherwise would not really be an issue?
Absolutely.
What do you do about that?
Well, I've had lawyers on the other side strike all the African Americans.
Mm.
And they'll try to give a reason which is not very compelling. And you just hope that you have a judge that's smart enough to say that reason is not compelling. For example, the lawyer might say, "I didn't like the way Juror 8 looked at me."
It's so coded, it's really frightening to think that people would try that. Is it something that most judges are sensitive to and careful about now?
Some judges. Other judges, no.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Lynn on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Great show, Chris. This is so interesting. My father was a federal judge, and he had this buddy that made a lot of money off of this book that he wrote about jury selection. And his premise was that certain people have certain physical characteristics, and he would sit there, and get paid a lot of money to say, "This guy's ears are big, which means, he's open-minded," or "This gal's ears or nostril is small, which means she's greedy. I mean, it was a fascinating book, which of course I lost about 20 years ago. But anyway, I still remember certain, of the things. I'm just wondering if you'd ever heard of that book, or if there's any, if that has any bearing anymore in jury selection, because it's just crazy. I mean, frankly, I think.
Excuse me for interrupting, Lynn. What year was the book published, or approximately when? Do you know?
Now, this was Daddy's been dead for many years. So this was like in the 70s.
Hmm. Have you all heard of anything like that?
I have not. I will say that the birth of jury consulting, if you will, as a field, was around in the 70s, the mid to late 70s. I personally have never heard about people's physical attributes telling you one thing or another towards a case.
I've never heard of a book like this, but I will say back in the early 80s, I think that people relied more on stereotypes, and now the lawyers rely and should rely not on stereotypes, but belief systems.
Was there a time, Lisa, in your experience when women jurors, potential female jurors, were treated in a different way than potential male jurors?
I don't think so. But what's very interesting, as a jury consultant, my belief is that women jurors are more critical of women plaintiffs.
Really?
Women are more critical toward other women.
And female attorneys.
And female attorneys,
as well.
True.
What do you think accounts for that?
I'm really not sure. I don't think I've ever been able to put my finger on it, other than it just sort of becoming a truth. Is they're much more critical of particularly the lawyers, but definitely the plaintiffs as well. I don't know why. It's maybe it's mean girl syndrome from back when we were younger. I honestly don't know what it is, but we are definitely much more critical of other females, and I don't see the same thing happening when males are being critical of males.
I agree.
We're speaking this hour with Lisa Blue, attorney at Barron & Blue, and Jennifer Lipinski, a jury consultant with Kathy E. Bennett and Associates. We're talking about what happens during jury selection. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about what happens during jury selection with two experts at jury selection. Jennifer Lipinski is a jury consultant with Kathy E. Bennett and Associates. Lisa Blue is a forensic psychologist and attorney at Barron & Blue. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Jared in Flower Mound who wants to know, is it outright illegal for an employer to fire you due to missed days serving on a jury?
Yes, it is. It's completely illegal. They are not obligated to pay you during jury duty, but under, I believe it's a federal statute, if I'm not mistaken, they are not permitted to fire you for serving on jury duty. Now, some employers do require that you bring a note from the courthouse and things, and they're happy to provide those.
That is a hardship for some people, not being paid for days that they miss work. You know, for some people, it's not a big deal, or they substitute in a vacation day. Not everyone with a job gets vacation days.
That's certainly true, and we refer to that as a financial hardship. And there's usually an opportunity, at least in every case that I've ever picked the jury for, there's always an opportunity for someone to speak up and say, this is really going to create a financial hardship. And I think judges are trying to be sensitive to that, as well as being sensitive to the needs of the court, by telling people, for instance, I just recently had a gentleman who was seated as a prospective juror, and he said, look, I'd love to serve. I think this sounds interesting. I'd like to do my duty, but I'm the only person bringing in any income right now. My wife's out of work. I just can't do it. And eventually the judge said, that's fine, and he excused that person.
Did 9 other hands go up after that? Or?
No, we try to do that outside the presence of the large group whenever possible so we don't start that trend because some people will, you know, and I don't want to speak poorly about anybody because everybody's got things in their lives they need to take care of. I totally understand that. But sometimes they see the door crack open and so they go, ooh, maybe I can go through too. And that's it can become a problem. And that's you just have to make sure that the best way to handle it is outside the presence of the entire veneer.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jordan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Listen, I love the topic. I love the conversation. I actually called because I actually love jury duty. You know, I've been getting, you know, summonses since I was 18 and can vote. And I look forward to the day I get dressed up. And, you know, it's my civic duty. And my family thinks, you know, I'm crazy. And my friends just are really intrigued by my zeal and enthusiasm for jury duty. But I love it. And I've never gotten picked. And so I guess my question is, how can I change that? How can I act a juror who wants to be on jury duty and appreciates, you know, being called? How can I change that? And is there a trick to getting picked?
That's a great question. Thanks for your call, Jordan. And I will tell you, you have two fans in this room. Both my guests were like high-fiving and very happy to hear that people like you are out there.
Yeah, we love you, Jordan.
Yes, we do.
I wish they were all like you.
May I also tell you, Jordan, that I've been called several times over the years and I've never gotten picked either. So you're not alone. And I would love to serve on a jury. It's my chosen profession. I would love to be in there. And I, for some reason, nobody ever wants me on their jury. Probably because I have too many opinions. But there's no trick to getting picked. I wish I could tell you that otherwise, because you obviously have a great respect for it and want to be a part of the system, and I applaud you for that. I truly do. I wish I could clone a few of you. But there's no trick to getting picked, really. I don't know, Lisa, if you would disagree with that. I think what the court system really needs are more people like you who are open and willing to, you know, give up part of their time and participate in this system. But you also need to be open and honest when they ask you the questions that's to see who's best suited to serve on the case.
I don't think there's really a trick, but the more people talk about their true opinions, they're more likely to get struck. And going back to what Jennifer said early, those that talk, walk, those that don't, stay. So I've been on two juries, and I'll tell you my secret to getting picked. I was an assistant DA under Henry Wade for almost 8 years, and I got I was going to jury duty, and I put down I was a government employee, which
and
is
didn't
true.
Say I'm an assistant
I
DA.
I didn't say right. I was, and it was a civil case, so mm-hmm. But it was the truth. I was a government employee. The other time I got picked, I put that I was self-employed. Again, it was true. But I didn't go into details that I was a lawyer. And so there are lots of ways you can write things, but of course you always have to be honest. And so, I mean, if somebody asks me what I do for work, there's a lot of different ways to describe. I'm a sole practitioner. I'm self-employed. I'm a lawyer. But you can see there's a lot of way to say what you do.
I will say this, though. Now, we now live in the age of Google. So I can say a lot of things about what I do for a living and try to get picked, because I certainly didn't broadcast the idea that I was a jury consultant the last time I was summoned for jury duty, because I do want to serve. I really do. That being said, if it wasn't the right case for me, I'd be the first person to stand up and tell the court. But, you know, I mentioned this to you, Chris, if you Google my name, one of two things comes up, either the company I work for or a photographer who works in New Jersey, and I forget exactly where.
And there's no prescription on attorneys who are sitting a jury or looking to eliminate inappropriate jurors on them checking you out ahead of time online.
No, there's nothing improper about that. It's improper if they try to contact you in any way. Mm-hmm. That's when the line has been crossed. But no, if the information is available publicly, it's fine. As long as, like I said, they don't try to friend you on Facebook, for instance.
All right. Well, we have a question related to that, I think, from Bill in Fort Worth. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for this show. Yes, y'all exactly touched on my question about just how far you can research a prospective juror And I was going to ask about social media in particular. You just said friends on Facebook, but just how far can you go in investigating a prospective juror insofar as social media?
You can get on the computer and look just like anybody else. I can tell you in the really big cases, the big pharmaceutical cases that go to trial, I know that they will hire maybe 8 or 10 people to get on a computer and to Google and to find out everything they can regarding that person's social media.
Everything that's publicly available, like I said, if your privacy settings are set so the only thing that comes up is that you have a Facebook profile but there's no information on there, that's where it stops. They're not allowed to friend you or message you or get any further information from that avenue. For instance, though, if you are a Twitter user, which a lot of people are, if you are publicly tweeting and your settings are such that anybody, if they find you on Twitter, can see everything you've ever tweeted, then that's fair game. That's publicly available information.
Do you all use interviews of any kind at the conclusion of a trial after the verdict has been returned to sort of get a sense for how well your voir dire worked for you?
Always in state court and federal court. It's likely that the judge does not permit that. He or she may on a few occasions. But state court, absolutely. I've never tried a case where I didn't talk to the jury afterwards.
What do you want to know?
I want to know why I lost, what I can do better. Did I annoy the jury? Is there anything I can change next time? I'd love to make it a learning experience.
And I'll also say this. First of all, I wish more attorneys were like you, Lisa, and wanted to talk to the jury in any opportunity they could. But I think it's also good to talk to them, even if you won your case, and find out what worked. It's definitely useful if you've lost your case and you want to talk to the jurors about what went wrong from your perspective. But I think it's equally valuable to talk to them when you have been successful in your case.
Do you have to think about what the dynamics will be like in the jury room where you will not have access during deliberations at all?
Absolutely. You've got to think about the personalities that are going to be together making a decision for your client. This is particularly important in any jurisdiction in which the jury must be unanimous, of course, because one of my favorite notes we got back from a jury was how many of us have to agree to be unanimous. And but that taught us something. It taught us that the attorneys and the judge didn't do a great job in that particular case of explaining the law to them. So I'm not making fun of them when I say that. But you've got to consider the personalities involved, because if they don't get along, at least on some level, they're never going to come to a consensus.
Especially as far as leaders and followers. I'm a civil trial lawyer, and I have put insurance claims adjusters on my jury, which normally you'd think that would be very bad. But they're individuals that to me seem soft-spoken. They were leaders. They seem kind. My intuition said they weren't going to just be hateful and hate everybody that files a lawsuit. So you have to consider how they're going to play together.
And of course, we hope that the jurors will listen carefully to the judge's instructions, but that's another variable, right? Are you hoping that there's kind of a watchdog for the rules in that room?
Well, yeah. I mean, the leaders typically take on that role. And a lot of times we started out in voir dire and we tell people, if you find that somebody is not following the law, for the example that I'd like to use is in criminal cases. For instance, and most people are familiar with this, that a criminal defendant is not obligated to testify. They do not have to testify in their own defense. And so in voir dire, a lot of times, if we know the client's not going to testify, we'll voir dire on it and just say, you know, if you're sitting on this jury and somebody says, you know what, he didn't testify, so he must be guilty. It's your obligation to alert the court that the law is not being followed, and we call it push the buzzer. So, and there's not an actual buzzer, of course, but it's just sort of a way to get them to say, you know, what do you do if somebody's not following the rules? You say you push the buzzer. You tell the bailiff, you tell the judge, and let people know. And once you kind of ingrain that in them, by the time they reach the jury room for deliberations, and also say this, once they've gone through the entire process, at least this is the feedback I've received, they're really invested in this case. They may not have, you know, been doing cartwheels when they got their jury summons, but by the time they're seated in the jury box, they've heard all the evidence, they've listened to all the witnesses, the judge has given them the law, they are very invested and they want to do a good job.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Garvin in Lake Highlands. Hi, Garvin.
Hello, Chris. Ladies, thank you for taking my call. I've been on three juries. I've only been called three times, and all three times I got on. I was the jury foreman twice. Great experience all three times. Cannot stress enough how if you haven't done it out there, folks, you need to do it. It's intriguing, it's interesting, it's great experience all the way around. Anyway, my question is, you know, in two of those three cases, we retire to deliberate and we start talking about it. And we had a couple of questions because, you know, they didn't let us take notes. And so we bring to the bailiff, we wrote our question down. And each time, it was on two different cases, it came back with, sorry, just deliberate and come to your decision with the information you have. That's it. Why won't they let us ask any questions?
Well, thank you so much for your call, Garvin, and I want to make sure we have time to get a response. So,
yes, first of all, Garvin, you must have a really wonderful face, probably a very honest face. And the answer to your question is, if you ask questions to the court is the one that decides, the judge, whether or not it's a proper question. So the judge will say, I'm sorry, we can't answer this question, keep deliberating. That is very common. Very.
But that should not dissuade anybody from asking the question, because I don't want anybody out there listening to think, well, I'm not going to ask a question because they're not going to answer it. You never know. It really depends on the law that the judge has to follow, but it depends on the court as well. Please ask your questions, because oftentimes questions do get answered. I'm sorry that that was your experience, Garvin, and I'm also sorry you weren't able to take notes. I think the tide's shifting a lot in a lot of courtrooms around the country and permitting the jurors to take notes. But definitely ask the questions. There must have been some legal reason why the judge was unable to answer the question for you, and I'm sorry that that happened, though.
Should people feel confident that the jury system typically works in America?
Absolutely.
Beyond any doubt. Remember, it's the Seventh Amendment, is the right to trial by jury. So when you think about what your forefathers fought for, that was one of the things that people died for.
And a jury is better than a judge in many cases. Why?
Because it's the collective conscience of the community.
And you would both eagerly serve on a jury the next time? Or are you called up often?
I'd be happy to.
Yes, I want to. I absolutely want to.
Lisa Blue is an attorney and forensic psychologist with Barron & Blue. Jennifer Lipinski is a jury consultant with Kathy E. Bennett & Associates. It's been really interesting to have you both here. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.